Russian President Vladimir Putin defends Moscow's military action in Ukraine, saying that NATO was creating threats at his country's borders. The Israeli military demolishes more Palestinian homes in the occupied West Bank under the pretext of lacking construction permits. Sri Lanka's Prime Minister Mahinda Rajapaksa resigns as nationwide protests intensified over the government's mishandling of the economic crisis. This is World News, a live broadcast from Tehran with me, your host, Behruz Najafi. Good to have you with us. Now, Russia's Victory Day celebrations have been held in capital Moscow. The annual event commemorates the defeat of Nazi Germany in the course of the Second World War. The celebrations started with a massive military parade. President Vladimir Putin then delivered a speech in Moscow's Red Square. He congratulated Russian military forces for their victories throughout history. Putin condemned what he called the moral degradation of the West, saying that his country will not deviate from its traditional values. The Russian president called the expansion of NATO alliance a direct threat to Moscow, accusing the West of plotting to invade Russian lands. He said that Russian forces involved in the military action in Ukraine are fighting for the security of their motherland, adding that those fighting in the Donbass region resemble the heroes of the Second World War. Well, on that note, I had a conversation with political analyst John Bosnich, and he believes that Putin's Victory Day speech has given him an opportunity to paint a clear picture of why he began the Ukraine offensive.
Russia has intervened in Ukraine to stop a war, not to start a war. There was an outcry of outrage in the Western mainstream media on February 24th when the special military operation began. But those same media were silent for the 8 years of preceding war that provoked the Russian intervention to protect the ethnic Russian population of southeastern Ukraine, which has now declared itself as independent and has been recognized as an independent area, actually two independent republics, people's republics, recognized by Moscow. So the picture of the war in the former Ukraine, in the now Donbass, has been completely skewed by what's called by Donald Trump the lying mainstream media of the West. And this opportunity today gives President Putin the chance to let the world public know that there has been a war. It was a war of aggression against the civilian population, an originally unarmed civilian population that Russia has effectively saved through a humanitarian intervention. And we know from the statistics from the operation that Russia has been running in Ukraine that the Russian military forces have done everything they can to avoid civilian casualties and are specifically focusing on their main mission, which is denazification.
The United States and its allies have imposed more sanctions on the Kremlin in response to the war in Ukraine. Leaders of the group of seven industrialized nations say that they will move to phase out or ban the import of Russian oil. They pledged to reinforce Russia's economic isolation, elevate a campaign against Russian elites who support Putin. And that's while members such as resource-poor Japan depend heavily on Russian fuel. Tokyo says it will take time to phase out Russian oil imports.
With regards to oil, although it is a very tough decision for Japan, which is heavily dependent on energy imports, the unity of the G7 is most important at a time like this now. In light of the G7 leader's statement, we decided to take the measure to ban the imports of Russian oil in principle. We will consider the timing of the reduction or suspension of oil imports while gauging the actual situation. In other words, we will take steps to phase out with time.
Russia was Japan's fifth biggest supplier of crude and LNG last year, but there have been no ships loading Russian oil for Japan the past 3 weeks. Meanwhile, the European Union says it's getting closer to agreeing tough sanctions against Russia that include a ban on oil purchase. The bloc has scheduled more talks for Monday to work out how to ensure countries most dependent on Russian energy can cope. Those countries include Hungary, Slovakia, and the Czech Republic. The United States has also unveiled new sanctions against the three Russian television stations and executives from Gazprom Bank. Washington has also banned Americans from providing accounting and consulting services to Russians. Ukrainian officials urging people to stay in shelters, citing the possibility of more rocket attacks by Russia. Deputy Defense Minister says danger of missile strikes persists throughout the country, with the greatest challenges being faced in the south and east. Ukraine's military says four high-precision missiles fired from the Russian-controlled Crimea Peninsula struck the Odessa area in southern Ukraine. It didn't provide more details. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said that 60 people were killed in the Russian bombing of a school in a village in the country's east. According to Ukrainian officials, the school was sheltering around 90 people when it was hit. The Israeli military has razed two more Palestinian homes in the occupied West Bank under pretext of lacking construction permits. Regime forces carried out the demolitions in a village east of Nablus. They also attacked local people protesting the move with tear gas and rubber bullets. 36 civilians were injured in the violence. The Israeli military frequently destroys homes where Palestinian families have been living for decades. The regime has destroyed hundreds of such structures in the occupied West Bank and East El Quds over the past years. And that's despite widespread condemnation by international rights groups. Now, meantime, Tel Aviv pushing ahead with its atrocities against Palestinians. The regime forces have killed three more people in separate attacks across the occupied West Bank. One victim, Mahmoud Sami Aram, succumbed to his wounds after being shot near the city of Tul Kerem. The Israeli army claimed that he was trying to cross a barrier separating the occupied territories. Another Palestinian was killed in El Quds over allegations of trying to stab an Israeli officer. And a third one was shot dead in a settlement near Bethlehem. Hamas resistance movement has denounced the killings, saying that they reveal the fact that the Tel Aviv regime is gripped by fear. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry has also condemned the crimes in the occupied land. Tel Aviv has intensified raids and bloody crackdown following the operations recently that left over a dozen Israelis dead.
Days after launching a massive manhunt across the occupied territories, Israeli military forces arrested the two Palestinian youths who carried out Thursday's deadly operation in the settlement of Elad that was established on the Palestinian village of Mzera, central Israel. 19-year-old Asad Arifai and 20-year-old Subh Sbihat were arrested in a forest near Elad. Israeli military forces, Israel's intelligence agency, and Israeli police all took part in the manhunt.
The two heroes were arrested, but we affirm that they carried out a special operation, a move that has made Palestinians feel proud. The Israeli regime mobilized all human, logistical, and technological capabilities to arrest the two youths. The Israeli military establishment will try to use their capture and publish the videos of their arrest to cover its security failure. But those two proved that the Israeli security is fragile.
Immediately following Thursday's operation that left three Israeli settlers dead and four others wounded, Israeli military took a number of decisions. First, family members of the two youths, who are from the village of Rumani near Jenin in north occupied West Bank, were arrested and interrogated, in addition to many others close to them. Experts now say the second step would be demolishing their homes as part of the collective punishment Israel imposes in such incidents. Israel urges the move is a deterrence act to force Palestinians to quit resistance.
It's one form of the collective punishment adopted by the Israeli regime. They think these punishments will stop Palestinians or prevent their operations. Israel knows very well it has failed to prevent such operations, and we can see that the Palestinian resistance continues and even has gained momentum.
A number of Israeli legislators and experts have promoted for killing senior Hamas leader Yahya Sinwar in response to the current wave of operations, which he has encouraged. Meanwhile, the group's military wing issued a threat for an unprecedented response and a regional earthquake should Israel attempt to harm any of its top leadership, especially Yahya Sinwar. From day one, it was crystal clear for Palestinians that the two youths would be either arrested or killed by the Israeli forces. Palestinians say what the two have done was part of their legitimate resistance. They add the operation was a heroic move and in retaliation for the Israeli crimes and the settlers' incursions into the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Mona Qandil, Occupy Ramallah.
In the meantime, social media has been filled with angry reactions to a recent Israeli decision to build 4,000 new settler units in the occupied Palestinian territories. Next hashtag trending is going to have a quick review of the people's comments.
Hey everyone, welcome to another hashtag trending with me, your host Ali Reza. The construction of Israeli settlements in the occupied Palestinian territories has long been a source of major dispute. The regime has constantly been expanding its settlement projects despite the international outcry against the move. The move, which, if it needs to be said, is illegal under international law. In another act of aggression against the Palestinians, Israeli authorities have approved a plan to construct 4,000 new settlement units in the occupied Palestinian territories. And in order to do that, they will have to demolish 12 Palestinian villages and deport more than 1,300 Palestinians from their home. Activists and social media users are now calling for an international boycott of Israel in a bid to stop its crimes against the Palestinians. They say that the regime's expansion of its settlements constructions in violation of international law is meant to ensure that there will be no Palestinian state. Our first tweet of the day comes from Ala Iman. Israel is a brutal military occupation whose goal is to steal more land by military force to establish illegal settlements on Palestinian land. It is time to boycott them completely and stop their crimes against the Palestinian people. Here we have our next tweet. It's written by Doki Doki Cloud. Daily reminder that Israel keeps violating international law by continuously building their illegal settlements. These despicable settlers were brought here from some countries in Europe, and look what they keep spouting, and the IDF military allows it. Emma DM has our next tweet. For Israel, settlements have two main functions: to ensure that the occupied territories remain under constant and perpetual control of Israel, and to ensure that there will never be a Palestinian state. Meanwhile, the Geneva Council of Rights and Freedom says that Israel's expulsion of Palestinians from their homes and the seizure and transfer of their land to settlers amount to forced displacement and are tantamount to a war crime. Our next tweet comes from Jane Samuels. She said, deportation of over 1,000 people in favor of expanding settlements, outposts, and training of Israeli soldiers is not only a humanitarian catastrophe, it's a clear step in de facto annexation of occupied Palestinian territories. And over here we have a picture of the occupation over the years posted by Eugenie. Is this making peace? Make peace for Israel was always just calm, continued occupation. Peace was just capitulation in disguise. Israel has zero credibility today, pretending that they never wanted settlements, but they magically happen. And you can see the progression of this occupation since 1946 to 1947, 67, and 2012, and like a lot more of this happened since 2012. This is just a rather old image of the occupation. Hazel Sharat said, 80% of the Israeli settlement's waste is dumped on occupied Palestinian territory. 97% of drinking water in Gaza is unfit for consumption. Israel's illegal occupation of Palestine has weaponized the environment, and AXA, it's an investment group, is complicit. Divest from Israeli apartheid now. Many are criticizing the United States for its support of the Israeli regime and giving it a privileged status by vetoing UN resolutions against Tel Aviv despite its continuous atrocities against the Palestinians. Warren McLeod said that every time the UN raises a resolution against Israel, the US vetoes it. Israel has privileged status regardless of their atrocities and constant expansion of their settlements in occupied territory, contravening international humanitarian law. Eric Gandara said the Republican and Democratic administrations since 1967 have asked Israel not to build in the settlements. Israel continues to expand settlements. The U.S. needs to back its words with actions on ground. Irfu Patel has our next tweet. Israel is an occupying entity established on Palestinian blood in 1948. Israel continues to expand its settlements on Palestinian land. The demolition of Palestinian homes and the killing of Palestinian people is this peace. And the final comment comes from BDS movement, boycott, divest, sanction. Since 1967, Israel has been demolishing homes and stealing land and water of indigenous Palestinians in the Jordan Valley, de facto and annexing most of the area to build illegal settlements and confining Palestinians who remain in shrinking enclaves. Hashtag sanctions on apartheid. That's been it for this edition of Hashtag Trending. Many thanks. Let's head back to the studio for the rest of the world news.
And moving on, Sri Lanka's Prime Minister Mahinda Rajapaksa has resigned amid political and economic crises besetting the island nation. A spokesman for the premier said that Mahinda sent his letter of resignation to his brother, President Gotabaya Rajapaksa, clearing the way for a code new unity government. The announcement came shortly after clashes between Rajapaksa's supporters and anti-government ralliers turned violent on Monday. Officials say at least two people were killed and scores more injured in the scuffles. Meantime, police have imposed an indefinite curfew in the capital, Colombo. Sri Lankans have been hitting the streets for months to vent their anger at raging inflation, power blackouts, and acute shortages of food, fuel, and medicine. In the Philippines, vote counting has started as the ballots closed in the election to choose a successor for incumbent President Rodrigo Duterte. According to officials, the voter turnout has been encouraging as expected. More than 65 million Filipinos were eligible to cast their ballots. 10 candidates are vying for the top executive post. Marcos Jr., the son of former dictator Ferdinand Marcos, and Lenny Robredo, the incumbent vice president, are the top contenders. Pre-election surveys showed Marcos, who campaigned with a message of unity and a rekindling of former greatness, was far ahead of his opponents. He's also a favorite because he's running in tandem with Duterte's daughter, Sarah, who is vying for vice presidency. Monday's vote was held in tight security. Iran says a visit by the EU Deputy Foreign Policy Chief to Tehran will put the talks for the revival of the 2015 deal on the right path. Foreign Ministry spokesman says Enrique Mora's Upham visit will focus on the proposals made by the EU Foreign Policy Chief during his recent phone call with the Iranian Foreign Minister. Said Khatibzadeh has stressed that the visit is part of the ongoing process of exchange of messages between Iran and the P4+1 as part of the Vienna talks. He said Iran and the group have been committed to a good and reliable agreement despite anti-diplomatic moves by U.S. Congress. He stressed that Iran is ready for an agreement as the part of the Vienna talks immediately if Washington accepts the Iranian nation's rights. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of the speech delivered on April 12, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the government officials of the Islamic Republic. Recently, one of these American clones, that is John Bolton, said that they would celebrate Christmas in Iran. Such statements are made, but the gap between reality and what they say is really wide. Therefore, when you see that the Americans explicitly say that the maximum pressure policy against Iran suffered a humiliating defeat, this is a very great and important issue. That arrogant, proud, and overconfident U.S. acknowledges that the maximum pressure policy against Iran suffered a humiliating defeat is a very important issue. Therefore, my dear ones, we must not become arrogant, nor should we become passive or lose our morale. We should become neither proud nor passive. These were two recommendations that I wanted to offer. There are a few professional recommendations that I will discuss as well if it does not take long. One is about the slogan of the year, which was about production with two characteristics, being knowledge-based and being capable of creating employment. They criticized me saying that these two things are not compatible with one another. They are right. In certain cases, this holds true.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The more advanced technology becomes, the less will be the need for manpower. Some people sent a message asking, will things be like this? My answer is yes. In certain cases, this is what happens. But this does not hold true for us because we have many factories which are either closed or half closed in downstream areas. Therefore, if companies become knowledge-based, these factories and companies will be positively affected as well. In other words, this will help increase job opportunities by several times. This is how it is. Therefore, we can create employment. Besides, new technologies have a natural tendency to expand. That is to say, the more we make progress in technological matters, the more available arenas we will have. So, creating employment will not be harmed, and making production knowledge-based can be worked on along with creating job opportunities.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
At least three Israelis were killed and several others injured in the city of Eilat on Thursday in an operation the Palestinian resistance groups hailed as a victory for the residents of the occupied Al-Quds. The incident took place on the day of Nakba, or the Day of Catastrophe, marking the anniversary of Israel's eviction of Palestinians from their homeland and declaring its existence.
It was the event when 3/5, 40% of the Palestinian population was expelled or killed or expelled from their homeland, Palestine, and expelled mostly going abroad to neighboring countries and even distant countries.
The operation took place after over 600 Israeli settlers raided the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound under protection from the regime's forces. Over a dozen Palestinians were injured, and some 50 others, including the elderly and children, were arrested during raid. In a statement, Palestinian resistance movement Hamas stressed that the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in the occupied old city of Al-Quds is a red line and that the Eilat operation reflects the Palestinian nation's wrath over repeated Israeli desecrations of their holy sites. The Islamic Jihad resistance movement termed the desecration of Al-Aqsa Mosque by Israeli forces and extremist Jewish settlers a declaration of war against the entire Palestinian nation, stating that Palestinians will continue to confront the occupiers and their aggression. The Muslim holy month of Ramadan has practically turned into a period of escalating tensions between Israelis and Palestinians. Israeli forces raids on the Al-Aqsa Mosque culminated in an 11-day war between the regime and Gaza-based resistance groups in May last year, a conflict that killed over 260 Palestinians, including scores of women and children. There has also been a recent surge in the number of Palestinian operations across the occupied territories over the past few weeks, raising fears that another war might be on the cards. The reactions to the mounting tensions have been particularly interesting. While many Western nations have kept silent about the developments, some, including U.S. President Joe Biden, have been calling on both sides to avoid violence and exercise restraint. A parallel can be drawn with the war in Ukraine. Is anyone calling on Ukrainian troops to lay down their arms?
In a way, it's the same thing that is causing the United States to back the Ukrainians and to be against the Palestinians. It's the United States sees an advantage and in putting pressure on a potential rival to its power, in this case Russia. They decided that Israel is the power that could help them to achieve that dominance. So it's all about in effect the United States ruling the world.
The normalization of ties between some Arab states and Israel has made matters even worse for the people of Palestine, despite earlier promises that the establishment of relations would benefit their cause. The Palestinians have vowed to continue their resistance until their legitimate rights are acknowledged. If the developments over the past several decades are any indication, they will make good on their words.
The United States is a permanent member of the United Nations Security Council. That title means a lot of responsibility, as every permanent member is expected to remain committed to global security and collective council action. But the U.S. has shown for decades that it is very much ready to take unilateral measures to get what it wants. A case in point is America's sanctions policy. The U.S. has gone outside the U.N. Security Council mechanism to impose tough unilateral sanctions against many countries. Even close U.S. allies may become a target of American sanctions. This is the Harry S. Truman Building in Washington, D.C. It is the headquarters of the United States Department of State. Many major U.S. economic sanctions programs targeting countries around the world are devised and enforced by politicians, diplomats, and lawyers who work here. From coercion and threats to financial punishment, the team does everything to make sure the sanctions are enforced. Perhaps the harshest sanctions ever imposed by the U.S. have targeted Iran, Venezuela, North Korea, and the Russian Federation. America usually defends its sanctions policy, claiming that it is aimed at changing the behavior of foreign governments. But ordinary people in targeted countries have been bearing the brunt of U.S. sanctions.
The United States uses sanctions as a form of hybrid warfare. It is a form of warfare, it's economic warfare, and it's a modern-day version of siege warfare. So you can imagine that the United States, without committing troops on the ground, uses sanctions as a tool in its arsenal for regime change and for pressure campaigns, both politically, militarily, and economically, on countries that do not kowtow to it, do not bow to it, and do not follow Washington's policies.
In Iran, the sanctions have caused economic hardship for people, among other problems. Iranian cancer patients, for instance, have been hit hard by the adverse effects of sanctions. That is because many firms, financial institutions, and banks, which are vital in importing medicine, have been blacklisted by the U.S. State Department. Iran has been targeted by some of the harshest American sanctions in decades. Washington refused to give Tehran any relief, even at the height of the coronavirus pandemic, when all countries needed much more financial resources to battle the disease. Although Iran has many years of experience dealing with such economic restrictions, a considerable part of its problems are being blamed on them. They have put a lot of pressure on Iran's economy, causing its currency to lose value and pushing up its rate of inflation to unprecedented levels over the past years. Iran's UN envoy has called on the world body's Department of Global Communications to intensify its efforts to inform the international community about the adverse effects of sanctions on the targeted countries. Addressing a session of the UN's Committee on Information on Wednesday, Iran's permanent ambassador to the United Nations said the use of the coercive economic measures are contrary to international law, international humanitarian law, and the UN Charter. Majid Takht-Ravanchi noted that the sanctions have undermined economic growth in the target countries and prevent their access to basic medical equipment and materials by blocking their financial resources overseas.
People can't have access to proper medical supplies, food, different types of technologies that are necessary, for example, aviation. You can think of transportation, things like that. Raw materials that are necessary just for basic industry and production. And overall, you see that there is a massive pressure put on the population in terms of their economic power to purchase consumer products because of the sanctions that are imposed. So it puts tremendous pressure on civilian population.
Iran has in the past described American sanctions policy as economic terrorism. Tehran says the U.S. is addicted to such coercive tools. Despite criticism from around the world, the United States does not seem willing to change course anytime soon.
Outrage is rising in Spain over a hacking scandal. It has now emerged that more than 200 mobile phone numbers in the country have been hacked. The cell phones of the Spanish Prime Minister and Defense Minister were amongst the targeted numbers. Authorities have detected the Pegasus spyware in the mobile phones of Pedro Sanchez and Margarita Robles. Prime Minister Sanchez's mobile phone was breached twice in May 2021 and Defense Minister Robles's device was targeted once the following month. All in all, 2.6 gigabytes of information was obtained from the Spanish Prime Minister's phone during the first attack and 130 megabytes during the second, while 9 gigabytes were stolen from the Defense Minister. Spain's highest criminal court opened a probe into how the mobile phones of Sanchez and Robles were infected. Madrid has described the hacking as, quote, illicit and external attacks.
The illegal tapping of these phones has been proven in an ongoing verification that will reach all members of the government. We are reporting facts that are verified and reliable, not assumptions. These are extremely serious facts that confirm that intrusions have taken place in areas outside a state institution and outside the law.
The mobile number selections, believed to have been made by Morocco, occurred in 2019. Spain's socialist-led government is also under pressure to explain why devices belonging to dozens of people connected to the separatist movement in the northeastern Catalonia region were infected with Pegasus. The regional Catalan government has accused authorities in Madrid of spying on separatists.
So the Israeli Mossad has had a constant intelligence-gathering operation against any client that is foolish enough to buy their materials, and this is being confirmed in the Spanish Prime Minister situation. So the CIA, the MI6, and the Mossad have always entertained a mutual intelligence sharing operation, and this revelation of the Spanish Prime Minister is just another example of that.
Pegasus is a malware developed by the Israeli technology and cyber arms company NSO Group. Unlike most spyware, Pegasus doesn't require its victims to unwittingly download it. Once installed, it allows NSO's clients to take control of a device to activate the camera and the microphone, see geolocation data, and read the content of messages. The company claims the spyware is used for counterterrorism purposes, but it's been accused of helping facilitate authoritarianism.
Well, the Israelis are notorious for the development of technology that they can sell to dictatorial regimes like Saudi Arabia, like United States, like the United Kingdom, as well as others. But they always install a back door as well.
There are now serious concerns within the European Union about the spyware. In 2020, a target list of 50,000 phone numbers leaked out and analyzed by international media and rights groups revealed that the list contained the numbers of leading opposition politicians, human rights activists, journalists, lawyers, and other politicians. In France, President Emmanuel Macron is believed to have been on a list of potential Pegasus targets. And UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson has been warned that his office may have been targeted in 2020 and 2021. It's now emerged that the phone of Jamal Khashoggi's wife was also infected with a spyware. Khashoggi was a dissident Saudi journalist who was brutally murdered in Istanbul in 2018. The European Data Protection Supervisor, the European Authority on Data Protection, is already advocating for prohibiting the development and deployment of espionage programs with capabilities such as Pegasus.
I think what we're going to see is the revelation that the Israelis are spying on everyone with the blessing of the United States, and you're going to see a departure from their technology and countries seeking more more solid, safe communication channels, such as that which is being offered by Russia, China, and India.
NSO Group has already been placed on the US blacklist. The decision reflects deep concern about the impact of spyware on US national security interests. An Israeli rights group has shed light on the regime's brutal behavior towards Palestinians. According to Hamoked, Israel is holding 604 detainees without charge or trial. Nearly all the detainees are Palestinian. The Israeli regime rarely uses administrative detention against Jews. The last time Israel held this many administrative detainees was in October 2016. Back then, the regime's illegal settlement expansion plan sparked a wave of anger and frustration amongst Palestinians. Administrative detainees are arrested on, quote, secret evidence. They are unaware of the accusations against them and are not allowed to defend themselves in court. The detainees are usually held for renewable six-month periods that often lead to years in detention. Israel claims the procedure allows authorities to hold suspects while continuing to gather evidence. But critics and rights groups say the system is widely abused and denies due process. Several Palestinians in administrative detention have gone on prolonged hunger strikes in protest, while many developing lifelong health issues. Administrative detainees and their lawyers have boycotted Israeli military court proceedings since the start of this year in protest, and the courts are holding hearings without them. Some prisoners have been held in administrative detention for up to 11 years. According to Israeli rights groups, 2,441 Palestinians are currently serving sentences after being convicted in Israel's military courts. A further 1,478 detainees are being held for questioning, have been charged and are awaiting trial or are currently being tried. Last month, the Palestinian Prisoners Society, or the PPS, said the Israeli regime has detained more than 9,000 Palestinian children across the occupied territories over the past 7 years. Palestinian authorities say 1,500 Palestinian children were killed by Israeli forces during the time span beginning at the outbreak of the Second Intifada in September 2000 up to April 2013. That's the equivalent of one Palestinian child killed every 3 days for about 13 years.
Well, absolutely. I mean, one of the things that's quite clear is that the so-called, you know, security domination of the Israeli occupation is very fragile. And in reality, the Palestinian resistance is exposing that on a daily basis. But that resistance is also taking place inside the prisons as well. Every single one of these over 600 Palestinians jailed without charge or trial under administrative detention are currently engaged in a collective boycott of the military courts to demand that this illegal system, an illegitimate system, come to an immediate end.
The Palestinian Prisoners Center for Studies, or the PCBS, said in a report in September last year that Israeli authorities had clearly escalated targeting Palestinian children. Systematic torture, harassment, and repression are all examples of the fashion in which the Israeli prison authorities treat Palestinian prisoners. The Israeli prison service keeps the prisoners under deplorable conditions, lacking proper hygienic standards. Human rights organizations say Israel violates all the rights and freedoms granted to prisoners by the Geneva Convention. Israel has for years held Palestinians in overcrowded prisons with poor hygiene standards.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
With the presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Brother Habib and Sayyid Mohsen. Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Brother Habib Zata, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah.
So, Islam and yoga. Okay, Sayyid Mohsen, if we want to, some people around the world, even in the Muslim communities, are practicing yoga. What's the problem? Where does the problem come from? I mean, because the feeling that your prayer, your du'as, your supplications, I mean, to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has to given to you is not given, and then the yoga is going to replace it. Where does the problem come from? Is it with me not practicing Islam in a good way, in a perfect way, and then replacing yoga with namaz or prayer or something?
Well, I disagree with the opinion that you said, like with the supplication or the prayer that we have. We do not get that kind of spirituality, and then that's why people are going towards the yoga.
Okay.
This is not the reason, because it has become a trend in the Western world. Now, the problem is those who have the, worldview, the material worldview, they don't believe in metaphysics, okay? And they don't believe in spirituality. On the other hand, they have anxiety, stress, different problems in the society. So they're after peace, some inner peace.
But Sayyid, yoga is spiritual action,
I know. That's the reason why yoga has spread in the West is because it was an exercise initially.
Mm-hmm.
It was introduced as an exercise which gives you a peace. You can find inner peace. And then later when people went after it and like the research has been done, obviously it has come like it's a specific traditional thing, which is a ritual in a specific, religion.
Okay.
But initially, when you look at the history of it, how it spread in America, for example, in the West, it was introduced as an exercise. So they introduced it as an exercise. And later, obviously, people know about the reality. So the reason was inner peace. Now, a person who is a Muslim who prays, he definitely finds some peace when he prays, when he recites Quran, when he fasts in the month of Ramadan. You know, he has that peace, but he cannot maintain it for a longer time. That's the main issue. You know, many people, they ask, like, for example, in the month of Ramadan, we are having very spiritual, mentality, but after Ramadan, it finishes. Why? Okay. Because they cannot keep it.
Mm-hmm.
So this is not the reason for the Muslims exercising yoga.
Yes.
Yoga is being exercised because of being an exercise, something new, where you do not move a lot.
Okay.
We are lazy as well. Okay. We don't want to have an exercise.
Usually yoga is a sit-in exercise rather than acting and walking or jogging or something like that.
Some people like that. Most of people are liking that. So that is one of the reasons. One reason is like why people are exercising it because of this. And in the Muslim world also, they are not basically exercising or trying to do yoga in order to have a spiritual level or gain a spiritual level.
They have ignorance
level.
About the fact of the essence of yoga.
They even don't think about this. Mm-hmm. They even don't have this mentality which we are talking right now.
Okay.
They even don't practice yoga with this, because when you ask general people, like, why are you doing yoga? They say it's an exercise. It's a trend in the world.
Okay.
You know, they see like people sitting on the mats and making different postures.
Yes.
So that is the main reason that they're doing.
Usually they consider it as an exercise or a sport or something like that.
So we cannot say like because people are not finding their spirituality in the prayers or supplications, that's why they're going towards the yoga.
Mm-hmm.
So it was introduced because it was an exercise, and people are doing some kind of exercise which has been a good trend in the world. Like it has a trend.
So what if a Muslim does, for example, yoga in the morning or something
that.
Like
I said that.
That.
If it is just the exercise, he's doing as an exercise.
No, and reaching peace, as you said.
No.
What if the spiritual peace is achieved, Sayyid?
No, they cannot achieve even yoga.
No, they achieve it, man.
Yoga has a long way to achieve it. You know, in the definition, I can just read the definition of the yoga. Like when they reach to it, it's not like, you practice it for a month and you reach to something. You have to practice for many years, at least 1 year. And in Islam, obviously, we have this, like, if you do an amal, if you do have to do something, practice it for 40 days. you can reach to something,
okay,
as brother was mentioning about some examples. So, you know, it's the way, like even in the definition they have said it, those who are the teachers of yoga or those who have started it, they say like when the five senses along with the mind remain still and the intellect is not active,
yes,
that is known as the highest state.
Mm-hmm.
Now, can you imagine someone exercising yoga for a month or two and he reaches to this state? No. You know, when we stand for the prayers, we have all thinking, all the thoughts coming into the prayers.
Mm-hmm.
We are not very much, you know, focused about the prayers. So this has been practiced as an exercise. And even if they feel something out of it, you know, we always feel peace when we do exercise.
Yes.
For example, the person who is...
I feel peace when I watch, for example, football games at the end of the day. It's
not, you know, no, is it a person, peace? A person, for example,
no,
yes,
spiritual peace.
No,
spiritual peace.
You're
no,
naming it.
No, sorry.
You're naming it spiritual peace, but that is satisfaction.
Satisfaction.
Yeah, I need to.
Yeah. That's what I wanted.
Yes,
that's what I wanted.
That's the satisfaction that he's feeling, and this satisfaction, maybe he named it as peace, but this is not the peace that, you know, the Buddhists, they say, like they're monks. What they say is as the peace which they find in the, you know, yoga.
Yes.
That is satisfaction. You know, if someone is doing exercise and he has this habit and he does not perform it for a day or two, he does not feel satisfaction in those 2 days.
A question just popped up to my mind.
Yes.
How about satisfaction in this? In the idea of Islam? Is satisfaction capable of being wretched in this world? Or is the true satisfaction in the hereafter? The true satisfaction, that spiritual peace that you're talking about.
And how are you
can
sure?
Can it be attained in this world? And like how you said, if I reach this in this world, how am I sure that it is that spiritual satisfaction? Why don't we say that's the devil and the demons playing tricks on us?
Yeah.
And so how can we be sure that yoga is not an otherworldly action?
What do you mean?
I mean, getting you into a kind of a spiritual perfection that will be usable for the metaphysical world. Because in the early teachings of the yoga, as I read it out these days, you know, I understood that it is very much like a religious action.
It's getting away. It gets you away from the from karma and from whatever negativity in the hereafter and whatever. They state that.
Yeah, but the modern version, you know, is very much, you know, this modernistic look at everything has changed the concept of yoga into something as daily routine fitness activity, which is very much different.
So from that's why you say it is a satisfaction, not the peace. You know, it's not the spirituality.
So what about the original form, Sayed? I mean, if somebody practices it in the original form, which dates back to before Islam. I mean,
5,000 years before.
Yes. Something before these monotheistic religions and these actions in the true sense of the word gets you closer to the, I don't know,
Well, the definition which they get, they say yoga is a skill in action, known that which is called yoga to be separation from contact with suffering. Now, imagine a person who is practicing yoga at that time, or even at this time when you go to the Buddhist, like their
ashes,
you know,
they call it, right?
The main part of their worships, where they worship. When you see that person is separate from the whole world, he's sitting on a corner. He's exercising yoga, which is part of his worshiping. He performs other things as well.
Yes.
But he never has a contact with this world.
Okay.
He does not have kids.
That's their goal.
You know, he does not have the kids. You know, this is what Islam stops us from.
Sorry, what about a person who is leading a prayer in his solitude without connecting the world?
What do you mean? It's very much
the same. I mean, for example, in your spiritual experiences, when you are alone.
That's accepted.
No, when you are alone, you know, you're alone for
a couple of hours.
You can think.
For a couple of hours.
We're talking about he's totally separate from the world. You know, there are two different things. When we're talking about the world, when we talk about the Islam says, like, the Ahlul Bayt, alayhi salatu wasalam, when they came, like, what was the difference between Sufism and Shiism? The Sufism has the same concept, like, you need to cut off from the world.
I'tizad, that's the concept of I'tizad.
So you cut off from the world. You do your thing, you reach to your goals, your spirituality. You know, we have many examples. For example, there was a lady who was a monk. She came to Imam Zainul Abidin, alayhi salatu wasalam, and she said, "Oh, Imam, I have these, powers that I have got from what I used to exercise."
But I'm not married.
And Imam said, "Like, how you got this state?" She said, "I never married.
Yes.
I never had a kid, husband. I was just praying, worshiping, and that's it." And Imam said that if this was the case, that if this was the criteria of getting to higher ranks and getting these powers, then why Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala made Hazrat Zahra, Sayyidatun Nisa'il Alameen, mm-hmm. the leader of all the women of the world,
okay.
where she is the leader of all the women of the world. She's
she
the
lived
mother
a
of the,
life.
Yeah. She and she had life. All these powers and more than this.
Yes.
Where she had the kids, she was taking care of the kids, she had a husband, she had a father, she was living in the society, teaching people. So Allah has put everything in the house. He had made this in the social life, that because we are the social animals.
Right.
So Islam is about being the social animal, being socializing with the people.
Yes.
Not getting away from the society.
Adding to your answer, brother, at the end of the day, we stated, both of us, that there could be, you know, these talents, these, you know, benefits, these rewards. They can be wretched. The satisfaction could be wretched.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's no doubting it. But who says that's the true satisfaction that you need? That's mm-hmm. the purpose of your life.
Okay.
That's the question that remains up there. How do you know that this is the satisfaction? And I'm 100% sure that they don't have no answer except that this is what we feel.
Mm-hmm.
This is what we know. We have gained it through experience. Who says that your experience is right? Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the creator, let's say. Let's not call him Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. The creator
yes. Yes.
has sent down over 140,000 prophets.
Okay.
Not one prophet I have seen has stated that you should do this kind of exercise, this kind of staying away from people and whatnot. Rather, what we see is like how my brother was stating, that you socialize, you help
okay.
your brothers, you build a community, you live your life normally, like how we usually do,
okay.
right? But there are some rules, there are some boundaries, there are some guidelines in this life and lifestyle. So at the end of the day, we need your evidence of proof that this
okay.
is something that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wants.
There are a couple of more examples
okay.
if I can add. Like, you know, for example, if there is a person like who's hungry, when you...
Mm-hmm.
give him a food, you
mm-hmm.
feel satisfied.
Okay.
You feel a peace inside you.
Mm-hmm.
Where does this has come from?
So as a Muslim,
yoga,
as
no
a Muslim
exercise.
Preacher...
You know, there was an animal
okay.
who was homeless. You're
yes.
helping that animal.
Okay.
You feel satisfied. You know, there are many, many examples that when you socialize in the community, when
okay.
you help people,
yes.
you get more satisfaction rather than, you know, being away from the society, practicing something on your
so
own.
If
that's
you wanna,
why
sorry.
In Islam,
okay.
that's why in Islam also, it is very much emphasized on the worshipping in a group, jama'ah, you know, al-barakah fil jama'ah, blessing is
in the jama'ah.
Of course,
you have collecting yoga
you know,
nowadays
why?
Too, you know, they do it in a group form too, you know.
That's
okay.
the, you know.
They have International
if,
Day of Yoga, you know.
If you
more
that might be something wrong in the yoga teachings.
Okay.
If you ask the Orthodox,
wrong.
You know, those who are Orthodox.
Gurus.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If you ask them, they will deny this thing because it's something individual. And everyone has to reach to their own level individually.
Doesn't it close the way of dialogue between, for example, Islam and Buddhism? I mean, negating the whole yoga or something? For example, if you want to talk to a Buddhist about the yoga and what are the benefits?
Well, it's a specific ritual that they practice. For
mm-hmm.
example, you know, if they come and they talk straightforward about the fasting or giving zakat, alms.
Because
yeah?
they do
no.
fasting too.
For example,
okay.
like for alm, charity
yes.
that
yes,
we do,
yes.
we have a specific... If they come and start with this, that is not the point of getting together.
Mm-hmm.
The main point is, you know, you want spirituality, we want spirituality. You want peace, you want this world to be
yes.
In a form of peace. We want this world in the form of peace.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to talk about the, you know, kulliyat, we say, like, what is it? The major,
major
topics, not the minor things. Because,
okay.
you know, when you go, get
universal
into
concepts.
The minor concepts and the
yes.
minor things, then obviously there are the disputes.
That's right.
You know, for example, between us and Hindus, we
mm-hmm.
eat meat.
Mm-hmm.
They worship cow.
Yes.
So how can you get, you know, united?
There's a cow in the middle.
Yeah.
There's a cow in the middle.
Okay. Thank you, my Said Mohsen.
Welcome.
Brother Habib, for your presence in the program. Viewpoints, that's all we have time for today's discussion. Okay. And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Viewpoints on IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/Call of Islam page, also YouTube, Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you. Fi amanallah. Allah.